We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft, is on the board. This morning in this part of Focus, we'll be talking with Karen Wang. She's the Vice President of Programs at the Asian Pacific American Legal Center. That's in Los Angeles. It's the country's biggest legal services and civil rights organization for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. She's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, has been spending some time talking with students. She went to school here as an undergraduate before going on to law school at UC Berkeley, and has been involved in the areas of immigrant rights and language rights, and among other things, for some time now. Before taking up her current job, she launched the LA Civil Rights Office of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And we'll try to talk about a number of things this morning about political activism by Asian Americans and particular issues, immigration being one of them. Questions as we talk, always welcome. We do hope people will make it a question, and it'll be on the topic, and you can try to be brief just so we can keep things moving along. But, of course, anybody who's interested in tuning in and calling in, contributing their thoughts, can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David, for having me.
I understand that you were yesterday. I think you gave a talk at the Asian American Cultural Center, and that you were talking about your experiences when you were a student and being a student activist when you were here as an undergrad. So this
yes.
would have been the late 80s, early 90s, and
yes.
I think at that time there was no Asian American Cultural Center.
It was far before
yeah.
the Asian American Cultural Center and the Asian American Studies program that are both now. You know, considered, shining examples of what you can actually do.
And I think that that's really worth saying and worth underscoring that I think that the University of Illinois really has gotten high marks as being a good place for Asian American students to be.
Yes, and that reputation, it definitely extends out to California. I mean, I've heard about that and marveled at that since mm-hmm. leaving, just because, admittedly, I was here a long time ago, about 20 years ago. But things were very, very different at that time. So when the students wanted programming or classes, we kind of had to do it ourselves. We brought in speakers. We, had all these meetings talking about, why issues that affected us were not being addressed. And now it's really great to come back and see that there's some institutional resources, really highlighting and addressing these issues. Mm-hmm. So it's really, really wonderful to see.
Well, can you talk a little bit more just about what it was like when you were here, when you were an undergrad at that time?
So this was late 80s to early 90s, as you said. I think during that time, what I didn't know then, but which I know better now, is that I was not the first, but part of the first wave of essentially second-generation immigrant kids. Some were actually immigrants themselves, but we were the beneficiaries of the post-1965 immigration boom for Asian Americans. And that happened because in 1965, Congress lifted quotas that had been placed on countries in places like Asia and Latin America that then allowed a lot more people from all the different countries in those parts of the world to come into the U.S. And so my parents were part of that wave that came in the late 60s as graduate students, and they chose to stay here and to make America their home. And so I was part of kind of the first wave of the kind of kids who were born in the late 60s, early 70s that came into college around that time, late 80s, early 90s. And I think that it was a time of change because you had there were Asian American students before on campus. There have certainly always been Asian international students here because of the excellent engineering school. But I think for Asian Americans like myself, we came in and really struggled to find our place here because we were mostly not identified as being Asian or international. Many of us grew up in the suburbs part of my childhood was actually spent in a small city in Indiana. I mean, we're from all over the country and really struggled to figure out how we fit in here. You know, were we minority students or were we not? Were we international students or were we not? And how did our issues play out in the larger campus community. And so that was probably a large reason why I became an activist in college. I was certainly not one when I showed up here. I told the students yesterday that I was a typical, I think, immigrant kid. I grew up in the suburbs. My parents said the key to success is studying hard and never rocking the boat. So that's what I did. I studied hard. I did not join student government. I did not speak out or protest on anything. And so that really changed here in Illinois. I think one of the great things about the vibrancy of the campus here is that I had those opportunities to really grow as a leader.
Mm. Well, did you, by the time that you left here, did you feel that, for at least for yourself, you had some answer to that identity question about who you were?
Yeah, and I definitely think that Illinois really, for me, actually, what helped to really define where I'm at now. So I've actually spent the majority of my career post-law school working in civil rights in some way or another. So I've worked both in the federal government and primarily in the nonprofit advocacy sector. And I trace that back to kind of the experiences I had here and the empowerment of being a student activist and realizing that actually, unlike what my parents told me, if you speak up, you might actually get something you ask for. If you just sit there and hope somebody notices you and gives you what you want, that almost never happens. I think our American society is constructed so that it encourages participation. It encourages and rewards in a lot of ways those who speak up and speak out. Those were, I think, a very important lesson that I've maybe more than others I've really taken to heart. I mean, of my many friends who did student activist stuff, I'm probably one of the few that made it a professional career.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I did just in trying to think about our conversation, I was taking a look at some of what is in the most recent issue of the Asian American Law Journal, which mm-hmm. comes out of your alma mater,
yes,
in Bald Hall. And in the most recent issue, there's the text of a talk that was given by Robert Chang, who teaches at Seattle University Law School. And this apparently happened back right before the 2008 election, right before mm-hmm. Barack Obama was elected. And the occasion, I think, for his giving this little talk, there was some sort of event that it was marking the 15th anniversary of the journal.
Of the journal, right.
So he was talking about that, and this was, as I say, right before the election. And it was a time when there were a lot of people in this country that were very excited about the candidacy of Barack Obama. And he says at one point, and he's talking about himself specifically, and I think he's also talking about Asian Americans and their political involvement. He says at one point this, he says, he talks about the excitement, and he says, yet this is a moment from which I feel excluded, and goes on to talk about the fact that it seemed that during the campaign, Asian Americans as a kind of a group didn't seem to him, and you can tell me what you think, that concerns of Asian Americans were particularly addressed, or that anybody really thought that this was a significant group of voters that candidates need to be speaking to. And I wonder, assuming that you agree with that, why you think that was, and can you say something about involvement or lack of involvement by Asian Americans in politics?
Sure. And first of all, thank you for the shout out to Bob. He's actually a good friend of mine. I actually met him working on the Asian American Law Journal many years ago, back when I was in law school. What Bob expresses, or I should say Professor Chang expresses, is a common concern both, I would say, within the Asian American community and also externally. And I think that there are a lot of different ways to explain sort of where the community's at as a voting or electoral group and what the opportunities are. I would say when you have an immigrant community like the Asian American community, and I think also like the Latino community, the two kind of largest Asian, or the two largest immigrant communities in this country, many immigrants leave countries where there's not an open democracy and voting is not kind of something you grow up thinking that, well, everyone has to do this or should do this. And I do think that for some people that plays out when they get here as, oh my gosh, it's so exciting, I can vote. And for some people, it's, I've never had a culture of voting. I don't really understand this. In fact, you might get punished for voting the wrong way. And so there's a disinclination to participate. So I think there are cultural reasons why for communities rooted in immigrants that voting is perhaps not as robust as we would like. Now, the counter to that is obviously you saw over the last 3 to 4 years, huge surge in Latino participation. And I think partially because Latinos have been or feel singled out for attacks by a lot of the anti-immigration policies that have been proposed. They haven't necessarily been passed, but just the proposal of different bills in Congress or in places like Arizona has really galvanized people who feel, actually, now that I'm threatened, I really should speak up and do something. For Asian Americans, I think it's more complicated because while the immigration policies of the country and even places like Arizona actually have a direct impact on Asian Americans who are heavily immigrants. We're actually somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% to 70% of our community came to this country as immigrants, was not born here. I mean, that's obviously changes with time, but that's a very, very high percentage. I think it's actually higher than Latinos overall. Immigration is important, but I think Asians are a very diverse group, first of all. So linguistically, culturally, they come from different places. Some come as refugees from Southeast Asia. Some come as immigrants with professional backgrounds, seeking opportunities in places like Silicon Valley. Some are like my parents, that came as grad students, you know, just looking for just economic opportunity more generally. And so I think that there's a lot of diversity within the community, so it makes it hard. You know, Asian Americans, actually, the one distinct, I think, that people who do work around elections and voting notice about Asian Americans is that we are hard to define and hard to pigeonhole. So there is not one issue or one thing that you can know for sure this is how the Asian American vote is going to play out. And I actually think that Asian Americans represent sort of where the voting public is headed. So one interesting thing is that increasingly voters are actually not necessarily identified with a political party. So it used to be that voters were pretty much either Democrat or Republican. But increasingly, it's not even third parties. It's actually a lot of people decline to state. So they're not registered with any political party. So in California, actually, there's an increasing trend of voters becoming declined to state, for example. But Asian Americans have been at higher rates of decline to state for many, many years. So in places like Los Angeles and Orange counties, that's where I'm from, Southern California, the number of Asian Americans who are in this decline to state category is enormous. It's something like three times as much as the regular voting population, like 30-some percent. I think it might actually outnumber Republicans, actually, in some places. And Democrats probably slightly outnumber Republicans for Asian Americans. So we're actually pretty split. And I think because decline to states are harder to figure out, I think with Democrats, Republicans, you know, more generally, you know, what might appeal to someone that identifies that way, what issues, how might they might fall on an issue. Decline to state voters tend to be very, that they'll take an issue and look at it and make a decision, and one issue does not necessarily tell you how they'll vote on the next issue. Mm-hmm. So I would say for Asian Americans, I think that's a very long way of trying to respond to your question. I do think that Asian Americans are an increasingly important voting bloc. If you look at the growth of the Asian American community in the country, not just in California, it is one of the most rapidly growing racial and ethnic groups. With that is the growth in the voting population. So in places like California, Asian Americans are actually larger now than African American communities. But I think because African Americans vote at higher rates, vote more consistently, Democrats, so that you know, politicians and people working on issue campaigns know how to target them, a lot more resources go there. For Asian Americans, because there's this diversity in how the community votes, there is the whole decline to state factor where you're not sure how Asian Americans are going to vote. Very few resources in comparison go into mobilizing the community. So I think that is probably what Professor Chang and others were referring to, that, you know, in this huge election in 2008 with so much energy and excitement, although there were a lot of Asian Americans engaged, a lot of Asian Americans went out to vote, you know, it sort of got lost in the larger shuffle because not a lot of specific attention was paid to the Asian American vote.
Yeah. One of the things that he talks about here, and I have no idea what these numbers would be like now or as we're coming up to the midterms, but he talks about the fact that in California, only half of Asian Americans were considered to be likely voters, or maybe it was that they identified themselves as likely voters. Mm-hmm. And across the country, it was only 43% nationally. And I also don't know how that compares to other. I don't know how that compares to African American voters or Latino voters. So that's a perspective I don't have. But to me, that's seems to be striking. And I wonder, you know, if people are not, if they're not voting, why?
Well, I think why people don't vote in general, not just Asian Americans, is complicated and multi-layered. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say I think what's interesting is maybe because the right to vote has been such a given in America. I mean, that was one of the founding principles, right? I mean, that we would be a democracy, that people would have the right to elect their representatives. I think that it's not taken with the same passion as in other places, especially countries where you see democracy being a new thing and people, you know, haven't voted in 20 years and or ever, and now they get to. So I think that there's actually generally a lack of participation. I mean, even if you look at the overall data, and it's been a while, so I don't remember the exact data for the Obama-McCain election 2008, it was the highest turnout for voters, period, any voters, Asian American or non-Asian. In several decades, I think, but it wasn't 90 or 100%, and we're talking best being something
and
like
compared
60 or 70%
voting turnout in other places around the world. It was
and I think it was interesting because it was a significant surge, but and actually in all communities, including Asian American communities, more people did go out to vote in 2008 than in any other year in recent history. So the election did drive a lot of people to the polls, and that lifted all boats, so to speak. Like all communities benefited. But I think in terms of why people don't vote, I do think it's, there is, I just want to put it in context of the general, like we as Americans don't vote enough. And I think that's, whether or not you agree with my politics, I think that it's sort of an American obligation. Like we have this right. It's a privilege actually that's not everyone has globally. And it's something we should exercise. People, I think, find it really easy to complain about policies and what their elected officials do. But a lot of people, don't vote. I mean, you even have people running for office who admit, well, actually, I didn't vote for the first 35 years of my life. But, now I want to run for political office. This is happening across the country. So so I would definitely say there's a larger issue. In terms of Asian Americans, I would also flag a couple of other things. I think language is a significant barrier. You have a largely immigrant population, as I said earlier. And I think for a lot of Asian immigrants, it's not that they don't speak any English, but I think in California at least, and I think Illinois, most states have ballot measures, right? So you have elected, every election has people running for office, like Senate or, president or whatever. And then you have issues that people are voting on. And candidates themselves can be complex because to know what a candidate stands for, you kind of have to read a little bit about them. I think there are significant challenges with language when people don't have equal access to information because, when I go in and vote, and I probably am more informed than the average person because of what I do for a living and the fact that I care about these issues. At my local election level, I'm voting on judges and school board members, and a lot of times there's just no information. And then what are you really voting based on? Whether a name sounds okay to you, whether someone's four-word title that they gave is, something that moves you. And I don't think those are the best reasons to vote. I mean, really, you should be informed about your voting. And then with ballot measure, it adds a whole another layer of complexity because, in California, at least, we vote on some very, to me, very arcane and very complicated topics like energy policy. And, in my mind, we elect the representatives for a reason. I mean, that's sort of their job, to kind of wade through and figure out these public policies. It's very challenging to have Americans of any background kind of weigh in on issues that are probably more than any of us. We don't really know about these issues, but yet we're asked to vote on them, and our vote will ultimately determine what the law is. And I think language becomes an issue because without adequate information, you have people who just feel really overwhelmed. I mean, I feel overwhelmed with an English language ballot in California. We might have a dozen ballot measures on in an election. So not only am I trying to vote on all these people, I also have 12 major issues that I don't know anything about that I'm trying to vote on. And I think that really does depress elections. I think we're in a society where the more complicated you make it for someone, the less likely someone is to engage. I mean, we're sort of in this kind of internet-driven society where things have to be simple and you have to be able to make decisions very quickly. Anything that requires extensive research and except maybe on an academic campus like University of Illinois, a lot of people aren't going to take that effort. Mm-hmm. So, but I do think the language issue is a major one for Asian Americans. It's something we worked a lot at my organization around trying to make elections more accessible to the larger community. So it's not every single language, but federal law does require for some of the larger communities like Spanish speaking, in some cities, Chinese or Korean speaking. So it's not every city, but in larger urban areas like LA and New York and Chicago, there are requirements. And that does help. We find in our work with immigrant voters that many of them who are immigrant generation will say that they make use of translated information to help them vote. And without it, they would actually probably not vote or have a very, very difficult time voting.
Well, did you – and I think there have been some documented examples also of people who had limited language proficiency mm-hmm. who were maybe who were trying to vote, maybe having a difficult time, needing some help, mm-hmm. really being treated rather badly mm-hmm. by the people who were working there at the polls.
Yeah, and that's true. It's true definitely not just for Asians, but I think for anyone for whom English is not the first language because, you know, you walk into it, you know, I don't know what the poll sites look like in Illinois now. It's been a while since I voted here. But, you know, there's like a ton of signs and most of them are in English and they have all these different directions about what you're supposed to do. And then the machines, you know, as we all know, are not that easy for the most part. So, yeah, I mean, there's those challenges. And then I think the poll workers that are in place that are hired by the local counties or cities that are running the elections are intended to help voters. And by and large, the vast majority of poll workers are great. I mean, they're people who take their civic duty very seriously. They're often people who are city employees who are given, you know, the day to go work at the polls, for example, to help their fellow citizens. But you do run into, examples, I think not that many, thankfully, but they've happened, and they happen every election. They happen in small towns and big cities where even in L.A. we've had poll workers tell Asians who came in to vote and asked for, say, the translated sample ballot in Chinese in an area that was heavily Chinese. They were told, you can't have it. You should just learn to speak English. Like, why are you even asking? Actually, by law, the poll site is required to have that information in Chinese in a place like Los Angeles. And that material is actually available because the county makes it available. So the poll worker just has to hand it to the person. So it does – I would say it's thankfully not the norm, but I think – it's still always shocking when we hear those stories because, you know, we're in 2010 now in a very multicultural America. And those stories should, you know, really not be happening anymore. I mean, if we want one of the criticisms of immigrant populations is that they don't integrate. They don't become part of the American mainstream. And part of how you do that is to vote, to participate civically. And I think that we should be doing what we can to make that easier rather than harder. And I know what I think a lot of people don't understand is that even the people who need language assistance, they're not necessarily non-English speaking. Limited English speaking means that your English fluency is limited. And I think that that's just a fact of life for people who learn a language as an adult. As an adult now, if you sent me to any other country, I can guarantee you I'm going to have a really hard time learning that language. You know, language proficiency is not something that comes naturally to me. And I think that it's easy for us who grew up here speaking English and seeing everything English. English is a hard language. And for a lot of immigrants, they really struggle with it. They learn enough to get by, take the bus, you know, do their jobs. But, you know, again, reading an election pamphlet, you know, is very, very complicated. There's a lot of terms and words and concepts that you wouldn't really know in your day-to-day life.
Yeah. We're about midway through here. Let me again introduce our guest, Karen Wang. She's Vice President of Programs of the Asian Pacific American Legal Center. It's in Los Angeles. It is the nation's largest legal services and civil rights organization for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. She's here visiting the campus, and we're pleased that she could be here spending a little bit of time with us. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send along an email, you can do that to will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to talk specifically about the issue of immigration and at least touch on the current controversy. Now, this is something that's been a big issue for a while, mm-hmm. but specifically, I think it's been a big issue and people have been arguing about it since the spring when the state of Arizona passed this law, essentially making it illegal for people not to have their immigration documents. Mm-hmm. And then when police stop someone for some other reason, they're charged with also making that person produce their documents to show whether they're here legally or not. It was tremendously controversial across the country. Many people criticized it and condemned it. I think some other state governments have actually said, no, we think that's appropriate and wanted to support it. The administration said immigration policy is the business of the federal government. So their argument was that it was beyond the state's authority. And essentially the whole thing is kind of up in the air now. A judge has set it aside in a sense, sort of say, well, it's on hold for the moment, and further up the ladder, the judicial ladder, mm-hmm. there would be rulings. So it's something that is still in play, and we don't know exactly right. how that's going to work out. But and clearly it is something that was designed to address concerns of people in the Southwest about people, undocumented people coming from the South.
Right.
Is this particularly an issue for Asian Americans, something that say, like your organization is paying attention to?
Yes. So definitely for my organization, and this is probably not a surprise because we are a civil rights organization, we are actually part of, so there have been a number of lawsuits filed in Arizona, one of which was filed by a team of civil rights organizations that are actually from around the country. So included the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. It included the ACLU, which has an immigrant rights project that litigates on these issues. It included National Immigration Law Center, which is a great group that does a lot of legislative work in D.C. as well as lawsuits. And my organization as part of a group called Asian American Center for Advancing Justice. And that group is similar to like a MALDEF, but based in the Asian American community. So these are all groups who do civil rights litigation and advocacy. And we came together and brought one lawsuit that actually was filed before the federal government filed its lawsuit, actually fairly late in the game. The Department of Justice got involved. We filed ours in the spring, I think in April or May. The months kind of blur together, but but a few months ago. And so there were a number of arguments that we raised as from a civil rights perspective. Probably the key ones were one that you mentioned already, which was that immigration overall, and it's been found in other court cases to be something the federal government is responsible for. So as much as there is sympathy for states like Arizona struggling with the local implementation of federal immigration laws, immigration is really a federal issue because mm-hmm. you can't regulate state by state, you know, who gets to come in or not, because then that really, you know, it's really about who gets into the country. Immigration is about who gets into the country, not who moves between states. So that was one issue. But the other one that we brought, because we were a civil rights organization, was around the issue of racial profiling, which you also alluded to. It's the issue of when people get stopped, like who is it that gets stopped? Under what basis does a law enforcement official you know, get to ask for people's papers. And that was a big concern for the civil rights groups because even though the law, I think, the attempt to write the law was to attempt to write it in a way that wasn't supposed to single out a particular racial group, particularly Latinos or Mexicans, really not even Latinos. The issue in Arizona is with the Mexican immigrants coming across the Mexico or Arizona border. There was a lot of concern about the racial profiling aspects of, like, basically some of the language in the initial the law that was partially invalidated by the district court judge was looking at, well, you know, you could look at how someone was dressed or whether they had an accent to determine whether there was some sort of reasonable cause to actually, you know, demand their documents to prove that they were here legally. And I think as Asian Americans, your question, I think, was more not so much like, you know, what were the laws about, but what stake do Asian Americans have in this or do we care?
Right, yeah. Yeah.
And I would say that, you know, this is, I think, even in the Latino community, but certainly in the larger community, it, as you said, this issue splits our community pretty cleanly down the middle. This is true, I think, for a lot of Asian Americans. But I think for many of us who care about immigration issues in the Asian American community, it was, you know, absolutely clear that there's an impact and that we have to care. And I would say it happens both directly and indirectly. So directly, our involvement is we actually represent individual plaintiffs as well as organizational plaintiffs who are in Arizona who feel that SB 1070 does affect them. So there are individuals who are Asian American who have already felt that they've been singled out and stopped in the few months since the law was passed before we brought the lawsuit. There are Asian Americans who actually have a very poignant history. There are a lot of Japanese Americans in Arizona who stayed after their families were interned in Arizona during World War II. And for them, anything that's racial profiling, regardless of which community it happens to, is very emotional. And I think for many of the Japanese Americans, that's what they see here. They see racial profiling that in the past was taking their community and putting them in these internment camps in places like Arizona. And they see it now playing out slightly differently, but targeting immigrants, including mostly their, Latino friends or neighbors, and they have also felt really impacted. So that's sort of the indirect impact. I would say on the direct side, one of the interesting things is that amongst the organizational plaintiffs we represent are, I think there's a domestic violence program that helps abused women who are immigrants. Oftentimes they're married to U.S. citizens or green card holders, and their immigration status depends on their husband. So if they're being abused, they actually have a really hard time separating because they're afraid of losing their status. And these shelters are impacted. Their clients are impacted because part of the law that passed made it a crime for people like you and me to help someone like that. Mm-hmm. So there are groups that got involved because they felt they were directly impacted, and their main mission was to serve. Like, their focus was not on immigration status. It was on, no one should be a domestic violence victim, and we should be doing something. Our work is to make sure they can leave these situations. Another organizational client we have is actually the Asian Chamber of Commerce. And people always kind of raise an eyebrow because they're like, oh, why would they be interested? And what's really interesting is that in the Chinese newspapers, for example, there's been stories now for a couple of months about Chinese businesses there feeling like the law has impacted their client base, because what's happened is that businesses that are known to cater to immigrants are losing business because people don't want to be in places where they feel like they would be a target, where if somebody wanted to make trouble for immigrants, why not go to a Latino, like a Mexican or an Asian restaurant where most of the clientele are going to be immigrants, whether they're legal or not, you don't know, but that makes it easier. And so these businesses, including restaurants, have said, we're losing customers, we can't really survive. They're looking, to leave the state because they can't make a living there anymore. And so the Chamber of Commerce felt very strongly about being a client in the lawsuit because they felt like this has a direct impact, on a group that people might not think would be impacted by SB 1070, small business owners catering to the immigrant community. So, I would say that there is a direct impact, and that a lot of Asian Americans do care about the issue. And our role in the lawsuit has actually been to represent those voices in that litigation. Yeah.
Let's take a call. We have somebody in Champaign who'd like to jump into the conversation here. Line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
I have a question. When you talk about Asians or Asian Americans, are you referring to like all Chinese, all Vietnamese, all Hmong, all Thais, all Cambodians, all Filipinos, Indonesians? Does it include India and Pakistan, Korea? Japan, this very broad term, could you please define it? Who's in there? My second question is, what are the estimates of illegal Asian immigrants in the United States? My third question is, there's a move here in Illinois to now deny health care insurance to children of undocumented immigrants. The politicians are playing with that football. And what are the estimates on how many Asian children in Illinois would be affected by that? And the final question is, this move to change the Constitution so that people born in the United States are no longer citizens. They do not get citizenship, and some people are even wanting to strip people of citizenship because their parents were illegal immigrants. What do you think of all those things? Thanks.
Okay, that was a lot of questions. I'll see if I can try to at least touch.
Keep us going for the next little while.
Well, I think the first question is a good one, because obviously as someone who works in the Asian American civil rights community, I make a lot of assumptions about who I'm talking about when I say Asian American. So by Asian American, I think what's commonly referred to, at least in the U.S. around, Asians in America is actually pretty broad. It includes pretty much all those categories that the caller described. Asian Americans are perhaps unique in the sense of being a racial category where, other than being from the basically largely speaking the countries surrounding the Pacific, on the Asia side of the Pacific, there is actually not a whole lot that brings these communities together. So it's actually sort of a construction, political construction here. In some ways, I think the Census Bureau helped to drive this a number of decades ago because, you couldn't really count Chinese separate from Filipino, separate from Indian. I mean, so we became this one big category of not just Asian Americans, but Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. So in that category, it includes people in what we consider to be East Asia, like China, Korea, Japan, Southeast Asia, like Thailand or Vietnam, Cambodia, Philippines is often included in that. South, or I think some people call it West Asia, but places like India, Burma, Pakistan, and for some, it goes over into places like Afghanistan. But for most of the work that we do look at South Asians, East Asians, and Southeast Asians. And in California, where I'm based, there's actually also a lot of Pacific Islanders. So a lot of our work includes people from Tonga and Guam, Native Hawaiian, the countries there. And so it's a very unique category because there's not really a common language or culture. But at the same time, politically in the U.S., these communities have come together because there are very similar challenges. I think the other questions dealt with different questions related to undocumented Asian Americans here in the U.S. So the question about, well, what's the estimate of Asian Americans who might be here and out of status? In general, when people ask a question about, how many undocumented immigrants are there in this country, that's a hard one to answer only because these are not people who self-select into being counted in the census or being identified. And so all we really have are really good guesses as opposed to hard numbers. But the general estimates have been roughly around 10% of the Asian American population. So actually that number is close to, a million and up. I think actually there's maybe 12 to 14 million Asian Americans in the country now. So it's a significant number. I think the one thing I would say for folks who are not familiar with the Asian American community is that when I talk about undocumented Asian Americans, they're not necessarily people who cross a border physically without status, which I think is a common perception of an undocumented immigrant, someone walking across the Arizona or California or Texas border. Although ironically, in Arizona, I think I've heard that the second largest group of undocumented immigrants after Latino is actually Chinese who are crossing over the border. So obviously, probably a distant second, but still second. But for Asian Americans, a lot of it is people who come here on visas and then overstay and then fall into the undocumented category. And it's related to an issue for a lot of Asian Americans, which is that many immigrants come in through family immigration. And there are so many backlogs in that process that people trying to come in legally actually, easily wait 10 to 20 years to reunite with family members. And some of them just choose to be with their family members. So there, obviously this is a failure of the system, but just as context for who is undocumented in the Asian community, I thought that might be helpful. Mm-hmm. The last two questions deal, I think, with, very significant public policy issues that are at play in places like Illinois, across the country, and also in Congress around, I think the larger public policy goal of these policies is to stem the tide of undocumented immigrants by denying certain benefits or privileges. And I think the caller mentioned, healthcare insurance, for example, for children of undocumented immigrants. The second issue, I think, was around birthright citizenship, mm-hmm. whether it's a longstanding, 100 plus year, actually more than that, legally, it's been more than 100 years that the Supreme Court has ruled that children, anyone born in the U.S., it automatically becomes a U.S. citizen. And that's actually, I think, one of the great things about the U.S. is that's, part of what's helped diversify our country so much. I think it's probably obvious where I stand on those issues. For me, I think the issue of undocumented immigration is very complicated. It's really, I think it often gets simplified as, well, what don't people get? Like, you're breaking a law, you're in this country illegally. But, when I look at the clients we see in our office and I look at especially the low-income immigrants who work in places like garment factories in California, it's much more complicated than that. I don't think anyone ever wakes up and thinks, I want to be undocumented in the U.S. and I'm going to break the law and come into the country. I think a lot of different things happen. Like I explained, the family immigration issue, which is huge for Chinese, Indian, and Filipinos. They have some of the longest wait lists. Filipino, I think, actually has the single highest one. For certain family categories, Filipinos wait more than 20 years. And we hear all the time stories about people who die while they're waiting to bring family members over, or the family member dies in the Philippines before they get here. Because a lot can happen in 20 years. A lot can happen in 5 or 10 years. And I think people do things like they come here and become undocumented because they can't do it legally. People try. I mean, people, if we had enough guest worker visas for people to come here from Mexico to do that, I think you see every single one of them taken. But we don't have programs and institutions that let us do this easily. So, I mean, in my perspective, I think the issue of immigration is much more complicated than people breaking the law. It's that if people are here and they've broken the law, there's usually a complex set of factors as to why they've done that. And it's not because they've come here intentionally to do that. They're, you know, wanting to be family members. They're looking for jobs. Some of them are actually brought in by American citizens who want low-wage labor. You know, you hear about – there was actually a huge trafficking bust in – actually, it was in Hawaii, but it was an L.A.-based company that apparently smuggled in Thai immigrants and took all their documents away and basically enslaved them for a number of years working on in fields in Hawaii. You think this is what happened in the 1800s. Amazing it's happening now. But, you know, those are the factors that bring people to this country.
Mm. Well, do you understand at least where people are coming from when they say that? They say, well, we can understand why people would want to come to the United mm-hmm. States, and we appreciate that, and we can understand why people would want to have their family members here. But they would continue to go back to the problem. They'd say, well, but it's illegal, mm-hmm. And we expect here in this country to be able to obey the law. And if I broke the law, they'd toss me in jail.
Right. No, and I do understand. I do understand. I mean, I, you know, although I don't agree with what's happening in Arizona, I understand why states, for example, have taken action because, you know, I think the one thing that people who work with undocumented immigrants and people who oppose undocumented immigration can all agree on is that there are major problems with our immigration system and it has to be fixed. I do think it's a significant disappointment that, you know, the president and Congress haven't been able to do anything. I think that was something that was widely discussed as part of the 2008 election that, you know, with the new administration, we were going to really tackle this issue. You know, I think the economy has obviously been front and center, and that's rightly so, because that it has been much worse, I think, and much longer than people have expected. But I do think the frustration for people like myself who work on issues affecting immigrants is that places like Arizona taking matters in their own hand isn't necessarily the best way to do it. I mean, we can't have 50 different policies around who gets to be in which particular state at what particular time. I mean, that's really a federal issue, but we need to focus on the federal government getting things done. And Congress is just completely paralyzed on this issue right now.
Well, people will recall this debate, this conversation was going on for several years, mm-hmm. certainly going back to the time of the Bush presidency. And one of the things that he suggested, and this was definitely aimed at people who were coming from the South, he was saying, well, let's create – in fact, what I think he was arguing for was a kind of a guest worker program. He's saying, well, if people want to come to the United States and work, let's make it possible for them to come to the United States and work legally. There were some things that made it kind of complicated about mm-hmm. somebody could be here for a couple of years and right. then they would have to leave again and that sort of thing. And there were questions also – maybe the bigger question was what about citizens? What are we going to – how do we address right. the issue of citizenship if those people want to be right. citizens? But why do you think it is that at least – that the idea that we should make it possible for people to come here legally if they want to come in and work, why that didn't go anywhere?
You know, I don't know if there's one reason. I would say one thing that I hear a lot in the work that I do, and I've, you know, you mentioned at the very beginning, part of my background, initially I came in to the organization I'm at as an immigrant rights attorney, and I was working mm-hmm. on different issues mm-hmm. affecting immigrants, including, you know, access to things like healthcare, which your caller referred to. I would say that you know, what's interesting to me is that I think there's a perception that that immigrants, Latino or Asian or even, you know, other, you know, we have other large pockets of immigrants in L.A., including Eastern European immigrants. So it's not purely Latino and Asian, but that there is a perception that immigrants don't integrate or don't, you know, become part of the American mainstream. And I think that you know, I don't totally agree with that, but I think there is a seed of truth in that, which is that it is, you know, for any community, and I would say, you know, you see this in the other countries when you go to other cities in Latin America or Asia where I've traveled, and you have expat communities, right? Americans will congregate with other Americans. There's a comfort level there. So it's just somehow that's viewed as different than here where you have ethnic enclaves. And I think it makes sense that people do that because, you know, people, you know, need a comfort zone. They need a place where they feel accepted. I do think the challenge is how we integrate immigrant communities. And this is actually a huge issue for a lot of people working in immigration right now because I would love to see immigrants more integrated into American society. So going back to your initial question about voting, it would be great if immigrants voted at, you know, immigrant communities. I mean, you have to be a citizen to vote, but there are many citizens in immigrant communities. Citizens in immigrant communities, if they voted at the same rates as you know, Americans who are born here. And I think the challenge is that the resources we have spent have been misplaced. Like, we're not spending enough on things like English language acquisition programs. There have been, you know, a lot of studies and reports showing that the demand for programs that teach English is actually much higher than what's available. And there's very little funding right now from the federal or the state governments for that. Classes don't tend to be offered at times when, you know, people work, you know, people don't work 9 to 5 anymore. So if you offer a class at 6 o'clock on Tuesday night, there's no guarantee in particular that an immigrant in a kind of a, you know, working class job is going to be able to take to do that. I mean, they've got kids, they might be working a second shift. So there are, I think, a lot of challenges. So I would say that while there's a lot of critiques about immigrants not integrating, not learning the language, not learning the American culture, I'm not sure that as a society we're doing enough to provide those opportunities. I think it is partially on immigrants to learn that, to want to do that. But if you don't make the resources available, like the English language classes, I don't really know how you expect people to learn that. You can watch TV and stuff. You can pick up a little bit, but, you know, that's not going to help you read, you know, the complicated ballots that, you know, come election time.
Yeah. About 5 minutes left. Let me just say real quick, our guest is Karen Wang. She's vice president of programs at the Asian and Pacific American Legal Center in Los Angeles. It's the nation's largest legal services and civil rights organization for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, and she's here visiting the campus. We have another caller here, and we'll try to get them in the time that remains. In Champaign, line one. Hello. Caller there, line one, Champaign.
Oh, yeah. Hi.
Yes.
I wanted to ask the guest, you know, historically in 1953, President Eisenhower expelled, I think, 500,000 Mexicans, put them on trains, got a couple of ships full of them. They jumped off the ship. Several of them died. It was, you know, today France is expelling less than 1,000 gypsies, and there's international outcry. I would like the guest to paint a picture. What would it be like if the United States actually decided to deport like 10 million people, with 3 million of those people actually being children that were born in the United States? What would that look like if the United States just made that political move? How many troops would it take? What would the TV pictures be like? Thank you.
Well, I would hope that the United States wouldn't get there. I have confidence that we're not the kind of country that would do that. I think it's, you know, logistically impossible. Part of it is that, you know, undocumented immigrants. I think one of the interesting things about the Roma, or what people call the gypsies in France, is that many, I think who's being targeted are the ones who have these encampments outside of, you know, the major urban area. So they're sort of grouped together. I mean, with a lot of immigrant communities here, there is no, like, I don't know how you would identify who would be deported. I mean, how would you mass check people's immigration status and figure out, you know, who should be here and who should not be here? So logistically, I mean, I just think it's not possible. I mean, we are a large country with a lot of resources. There's no way I think we can mobilize resources, even if it's only 10% of the population. As the caller said, it's, you know, 10 or 12 million people, most of whom we don't know for sure. And the way undocumented immigrants are in our country is that they are actually integrated with legal immigrants and citizens. So the vast majority of immigrant families include people of different statuses, people who are U.S. citizens, either born or naturalized, people who are green card holders, so they're legal immigrants, and people who may be undocumented for whatever reason. And in many families, particularly in the Latino community, but also in the Asian community, you find people who are all those different statuses. So, you know, it's I don't know how you would do that. So I guess I don't. My short answer to the question is just that logistically that would be impossible.
Well, I think, I mean, I think the caller was not suggesting that we should do this, but I think was perhaps pointing to that the fact that there are some people who would say, well, we should do this, and that we should, you know, this 10, 11 million, 12 million undocumented people, that we simply should just should send them home. And I think that the practical response is, maybe whether you think that or not is or not a good idea, it's just not possible. So, you know, that we're going to have to figure out some other way to deal with the issue of people who are here who are undocumented. That one, arresting everybody, that is just – that's not tenable. Either, you know, politically or otherwise.
Right, and thank you for clarifying that, because I did understand that as the caller's question, but I guess my point was that it's no matter what resources you want to throw at it, it's going to be impossible to do. I would say, I mean, I think that actually the flip side to that is, you know, because I do think the image of the U.S. horde, you know, like pushing people out of the country like that, I mean, in some ways, I think that would be too much for most people. I mean, I think people talk about that, but if you actually saw that, and the caller referred to, a lot of these are people with children who are here. Some of the children are undocumented. A lot of them are not. But it's a horrifying image, you know, kind of harks back to an earlier era that I think we've all left behind, like the Japanese-American internment, people being hoarded on trains, you know, into these camps. But I would say, go back to my earlier point, which is that I really think the way to deal with it is not about trying to, like, isolate individuals who we need to kick out of the country, but not everyone, but many, many of these immigrants want to be here, and they want to be American citizens. They want, you know, my parents came here, and they had no intention of going back. They wanted to settle here. They wanted, they didn't even want me to learn, you know, Chinese, which I know I regret. Everybody speaks Mandarin, but they really wanted to integrate here and have our family stay here. And I think what we should be doing is providing more resources and opportunities for that to happen and encouraging that versus going the other way.
Yeah. Well, I think we're just about the point that we're going to have to finish up. And again, I want to say thanks to our guest, Karen Wang. She's the Vice President of Programs at the Asian Pacific American Legal Center in Los Angeles. That is the nation's biggest legal services and civil rights organization for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. And if you're interested in finding out more about the organization and its activities, they do indeed have a website so that you can go on the web and check them out. Karen was a graduate of the University of Illinois, did her undergraduate work here before going on to law school at UC Berkeley. And then she worked for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and now for the center. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
For being with us. We really appreciate it.